Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Should a college be held responsible for a student's suicide? That's the question before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court this week in the case of Han Nguyen, an MIT grad student who killed himself in 2009. Nguyen, a 25-year-old PhD student, had met with psychiatrists at MIT's mental health clinic. He'd also reported a history of depression and suicide attempts in college. Faculty members had also expressed some concern about him. Jeffrey Beeler, the family's attorney, says that because MIT was aware of Nguyen's serious struggles with mental health, the university had a duty to do more to prevent his suicide.
That was their role. They said they were going to do that. They said, we're going to stay in touch and connection with the student. 2007, they had him, and they dropped him.
Attorney Kevin Martin, representing MIT, says that Nguyen had chosen to pursue treatment outside of MIT, and universities do not have a duty to protect students from self-inflicted harm.
Society does not expect, for example, a landlord to protect a tenant from committing suicide in their own apartment building.
That's sound from oral argument this week before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Well, joining me now with some analysis is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
This is a complex and interesting case. I mean, what's your first thought about this big question? Should universities be responsible?
Well, I think the answer is it depends, and as it always does. I mean, so there's never a duty to prevent a suicide. If someone is, you know, just in general walking down the street, you don't have a duty. There are certain special relationships. Somebody in prison, when the prison authorities know about them being suicidal. A university is in a different kind of situation. The university has a duty to protect, you know, to make sure that no one breaks down the door of the dorm. And I suppose on the other end, if the university actually knew that this young man was suicidal and he sought services there, there could be obligations that adhere to the university. But that's the factual question here, whether they knew when he sought outside help.
Well, so to that point, I just want to play another bit of tape from the family's lawyer, Jeffrey Beeler. And Beeler told the SJC that he argued that the college does have, the university does have a, quote, duty of reasonable care, even if a student does not have an imminent risk of suicide. Here's what Beeler said.
If you say to the schools, you don't need to use reasonable care except during what would be a imminent suicide crisis, a kid standing on the side of the building saying, I'm going to throw off or jump off. What you do is you miss the opportunities that these schools have to intercede earlier in the process, which is when you can save these students.
Judge Gertner, react to that.
That's an extraordinary thing to say. That would essentially make schools, require schools to be proactive with students. And in particular, this is a 25-year-old student. It would require, and one policy argument is that it would require intervention. It would have implications for privacy of students. It would require them to stand in the shoes of a intervening parent in the ways that we usually don't require them to do. It's one thing to say, you got to make sure that the locks are working on the doors and, you know, that the premises are safe. But now you're talking about intervening in what is a very difficult situation. It seems to me that's a different issue.
Does it matter that he was 25 and a grad student and not an undergrad?
It matters. It matters. I think, you know, no one has ever set up this duty of a college to intervene in this way. And if they're going to do that, it's not likely to be with respect to a graduate student at that age. It's likely to be, if it occurs at all, at younger ages in a different kind of setting.
Like below 21?
Yes, that's right. That's right. But even with respect to that, the university doesn't stand in the same shoes as, you know, the prison guard vis-a-vis the prisoner, where basically you have all obligation to watch that person all the time. This would be an obligation to intervene, which is very unusual, and we so far haven't put on colleges and universities.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, we're seeing that advisors at MIT had recommended that Nguyen pass classes regardless of his performance. He was sent to meet with MIT Mental Health Services in 2007 and that he had continually sought psychiatric treatment, not just at MIT, but 9 hospitals as well, MGH, McLean, throughout his time at MIT. And then in addition to that, we have some more tape from MIT's lawyer, Kevin Martin, you know, given the backdrop of the number of hospitals that Nguyen had visited for treatment. Kevin Martin, again, representing MIT, claims that the student wanted to keep his mental health treatment and his academic lives separate.
Students these days quite reasonably expect that the decisions they make about their own medical treatment, including mental health treatment, will be respected by their universities.
I mean, again, this sort of gets to that line of like a question of where do we draw the line? He was seeking treatment outside of MIT, so how much should MIT be responsible for knowing about that?
That's what I'm saying. There's never been an affirmative duty for a college to make sure that everyone is, you know, fine and not suicidal who are within the walls of the college. There may well be a duty if they expressly knew about a particular kid with suicidal ideation where they think it's going to be imminent. So where this fits between the one hand, where there's no obligation in the general case, and on the other, where you know about a particular threat to a particular kid, is another issue. This sounds like what happened in the court below is the court dismissed the case, and I would bet that the SJC is going to affirm that.
Mm. Well, but let me ask you, I mean, universities have been taking greater responsibility for student safety when it comes to potential threats from third parties,
right,
for example.
But safety is a different issue because a student
safety
can't,
from self-harm?
Well, a student can't affect that safety herself, right? You can't fix the locks and make sure there are guards and video. But with a particularly a 25-year-old student, they can take steps to seek out help. In other words, it's not the same thing as locks and doors and guards as with respect to complex mental health issues. That's why if something comes out of this at all, it would be an obligation, it seems to me, to intervene when you know specifically that intervention is appropriate. Otherwise, you're talking about a duty with respect to, you know, everyone, which would be very difficult and very taxing to a university.
So that's why this case is so interesting, though, because Nguyen's family and lawyers arguing that MIT did know. I mean, that faculty members were so concerned about his mental health that they were saying you should just pass him in his classes so
right,
as to not, you know, further his mental anguish.
Well, but being concerned about mental health is not the same thing as being concerned that someone's going to throw themselves off a roof. Being concerned about mental health may well be, you know, qualify every student in graduate school at MIT. But the question is whether they knew enough to believe that suicide was imminent. Again, bearing in mind that the decision to take one's own life is a complicated decision, that we ordinarily don't hold people responsible for someone else's decision to do that, except under very narrow circumstances.
You know, in briefs to the court, 18 Massachusetts universities have written that a professor checking in on a student's mental health status, they argue, could actually prevent students from reporting health or mental health concerns. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I think that I read that as well. I mean, that could be, that's certainly a student that could basically then not tell people about it. But it also creates affirmative obligations for colleges and universities, which has implications for privacy, resources, all sorts of things, which we have not. I mean, it's creating, you know, the concept was parents patriae, the notion of standing in the shoes of the parents. This would be a much more aggressive standing in the shoes of a parent than we've ever seen before. That's why I think this is very different and not likely to succeed.
Well, Judge Gertner, while I've got you, can I ask you some questions in a couple more other areas
sure.
of the law? Let's turn to...
Ask me anything.
What's your favorite color? I know what your favorite color is. It's red. But you have actually recently written a piece in the Globe on the state's criminal justice reform bill. The Massachusetts House plans to start a debate on that very soon. And you've talked a lot about compassionate release for inmates. And the House bill has a provision for a compassionate release. What do you think?
Well, I represented Sal DeMacy, who used the federal compassionate release mechanism to be able to apply to the Bureau of Prisons to say that because he had two cancers and could not swallow, he could not function in a prison environment, losing weight, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, Bureau of Prison recommended that he be released, and he was released. There was, up until this bill, There was no provision for a dying prisoner to in the state system to apply for compassionate release. We simply had no mechanism. We're one of the few states without any mechanism to do so. And what that means is that we wind up spending, aside from the humanity of it, we wind up spending a huge amount of money on people who are on dialysis 24/7, who can't walk, who are amputees and have posed no threat to society and clearly just want to live out their lives out on the outside. We have no mechanism. There's a difference between the House bill, which has a much better mechanism for compassionate release than the Senate bill, but we have to do something. It can't be a political decision. It needs to be a medical decision. And it has to be a medical decision, not just you are at death's door, you're going to leave, you know, we're going to let you out because you're going to die any minute. But it has to be where the medical situation so impairs this person's ability to function in prison that we're essentially talking about torture. Mm. You're talking about cruel and unusual punishment at a certain level.
Oh, that's strong. You're putting out some strong language there, because I think people would would disagree with you. There are still very many people who believe that if you are given a sentence by a jury of your peers or a judge, that is the sentence you must serve out.
I appreciate those arguments. There's a certain point at which, though, medical conditions that no one could have anticipated so undermine your ability to function in prison, when there's no public safety issue, when it does not make sense for this person to continue within the four walls, and especially when, as I said, many other states who are far less, quote, progressive than Massachusetts have such provisions, and most industrial countries have a provision. The notion here is you get sentenced with one set of facts, what you did and who you are at that moment, and then facts can develop that affect your medical situation, which if a court maybe had known about at the beginning, could have affected your sentence.
So more broadly about criminal justice reform in Massachusetts, the Senate did pass its own version of the bill, and 9 Massachusetts DAs came out against the Senate version of the bill, saying that it would turn the clock back on important measures put into place by the legislature establishing victims' rights. And I think that, again, this is an argument that it falls on a lot of sympathetic ears, because this is always the question when considering criminal justice reform: what about the victims?
Right. The premise of the DA's letter was all off. The notion that eliminating mandatory minimums would somehow improve public safety and help the victims is simply a false premise.
Or preserving mandatory minimums.
Right. This is completely a false premise. What we have seen is that the states that have in fact effected criminal justice reform, eliminated mandatory minimum sentencing, have seen their crime rates decline. It's simply not, there is no correlation between a mandatory sentence and the crime rate. And people need to know that, and the victims need to know that. I mean, in addition, the other side of the mandatory minimum, which I've written about, is Massachusetts may have a relatively low rate of incarceration, but we have one of the most disproportionate sentencing of African Americans and Hispanics in the country. And so the locus of that discrimination has to be from district attorneys who are making charging decisions about who gets the mandatory minimum and who doesn't. And because it's not the judge, right? Once they charge, the judge is not making those distinctions. So if only to eliminate an egregious disparity, we have to eliminate mandatory minimums.
Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Judge Gertner. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.